Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. My very special guests today are Vicente Rodriguez and Henry Magala with Aguilas del Desierto. That's a nonprofit organization made up of volunteers whose mission is the search, rescue, and recovery of undocumented immigrants who become lost in the deserts or mountains while crossing the border in California and Arizona primarily. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Miriam. Thanks for having us.
I am Vicente Rodriguez. I'm glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you both. So, Vicente, let's start with you. Can you tell me a little bit about how and why Aguilas del Desierto got started?
Aguilas del Desierto is a search and rescue nonprofit organization. It searches along the border for the migrants who get lost or they die along the border. We do lots of border remains recovery, and we work in California and Arizona, but we do have information and links throughout the entire border, including Texas.
Now, the sad statistic, according to the Border Patrol, is that since 1998, when the wall first started being built, I guess, 7,000 migrants are known to have died crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. And that doesn't reflect those who've never been found or who died on the Mexican side, of course. And some estimate the toll could be over 10,000.
Yes, that's true. In 2008, there was a reporter from PBS that made an examination of the actual numbers for 2008. Actually, she made it later than that. But the figures are from 2008. In that year, the Border Patrol reported 400 and something that had died. But the reporter found out that there was an additional 400 that had died that were found by the sheriffs and other people. And so the total for that year was 864, and that didn't include the ones who were never found. So the ones that were never found, it could have been easily 200. So we're talking maybe 1,000 or more.
Yeah. Now, I understand that it was started by a man whose own brother was one of the victims who perished out in the desert or the mountains. Tell us the story.
There was a number of founders because there was a small group that had been working before. But we sat down one day and decided to make Aguilas del Desierto. And we named the founder, Eli Ortiz, as president. And the reason we made him president is because he had lost a brother and a cousin out in the desert in Arizona. We actually had gone out three times to look for him, and we finally found the two individuals. This was in 2009, and he had a lot of problems trying to get somebody to go and find the bodies, and then he had problems trying to claim the bodies and ship them to Mexico.
Yeah, so it's certainly filling an important need. Henry, tell us how you came to be involved with Aguilas del Desierto, which, by the way, listeners, means Eagles of the Desert.
They came across my Facebook feed one day. I connect with all my colleagues and friends through Facebook, and I saw one of their ads show up. My background's in international public health, international humanitarian aid and development, and I was very interested in their mission and what they were doing. I sent them an email introducing myself, asking them how I can be of help and service, and they were instantly very welcoming, very kind. I asked them if I could volunteer. They said, sure. They told me when to show up. I went out the first time, and I've gone out every time since then.
Very good. Tell us about what happened on some of those trips.
All the searches I've been on have been in Arizona except for one. I was in one in Calexico. But we head out on a Friday afternoon, get out to Arizona, usually around 10 o'clock at night. If we're lucky enough, somebody who's welcoming, sympathetic to our cause will let us sleep on their floor in their house somewhere. And we go out and about 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning the next day, we go out and search the desert, usually someplace off the charts, away from trails, places where people don't want to be found. And we search literally all day long. It can be really difficult, challenging, and even dangerous out there, because in August when we were out there, it was 115 degrees. I had my camera with me, and I couldn't even hold on to my camera any longer. It got so hot. It's amazing. You have to worry about what you're stepping on, because there's cactus everywhere. There are rattlesnakes. There are sharp rocks. There's that lava rock. And then you're trying to look around for bones that are bleached that look like rocks, and you're trying to see where you're going, what you're stepping on, what you're trying to avoid to step on. It's just amazing that the people that we're looking for are trying to do the very same thing at nighttime.
Can you tell us the human stories about some of the actual individuals that you've found?
On that first trip that we went on, we were looking, you know, we get called, typically Vicente or one of the other leaders gets a phone call from either a coyote or a family member that said, hey, or somebody else who crossed said, hey, we were just crossing and we came across a body or a remains. You may want to go look and see if you can find them. And they give us a general description of where that is. The first time I went out, we were looking for a guy, I can't recall his name, but he was a 39-year-old guy, had been living in the United States for 19 years already in Miami, and working, had a job out there, a wife and a daughter, and he was just trying to make it back to his family, making it back to his wife and daughter.
So he'd gone back to Mexico and then was trying to come back to the U.S. where he'd been for 19 years and had family.
Correct. Yeah, he went back, I think, to visit his own family and take some, I'm not sure to take money back, but probably just visit his own family, trying to make it back to his job and his family, and didn't make it across the border. The last time we just went out a couple of weeks ago, we got a call, from a coyote who said that he had to leave somebody behind because they fell and hurt their knee really bad, a young kid. We were called. We went out there about 6 days after he was left behind. Weren't sure if he was still alive or not. We searched for a couple of days and didn't find him, but got a call later on from somebody that said that he had made it, that he did live through the desert. But many of the times when we go out searching, we have a picture and a name and are looking for someone in specific.
Now, I understand that you work closely with the Border Patrol and sort of follow their rules so that they cooperate with you. Tell us about that. What does that entail?
The Border Patrol initiated what they call a missing migrant program, where they work with us and we share information back and forth. What happens is when the group crosses and they leave somebody behind, or they see somebody, they might call the family, or they might call us and provide us with that information, and maybe even the family will call us. What we do is we know a lot of things about the border. Actually, I was born on the border, so we have links with the Border Patrol throughout the entire border, including Texas, and what we'll do is we'll share that information with the Border Patrol as to rescuing the live person or recovering the body.
Now, there was a dramatic story in some of the information you sent me, Henry, about somebody who was actually found alive and they had sort of buried themselves in the sand to survive. So what happens when you find somebody like that and they're alive but they're in medical need?
Well, what happens is when we find something like that, and that does happen, by the way, people will be out in the desert and temperature is 115, 120, 125 even. And so they will go out of their mind, just literally. And you don't know what they'll do. But if we find somebody with a broken leg or a person like that, we'll call the Border Patrol and they will send a paramedic out to the unit.
And then they wind up deported, but their life is saved.
And even a helicopter, if it's available, they do have a helicopter. The Border Patrol does have what they call BORSTAR, the Border Patrol Rescue, Search mm-hmm. and Rescue Unit.
Yeah.
And we will notify the Border Patrol.
And I understand you're not allowed in Arizona to leave things like, you know, humanitarian aid, say water or food or blankets out there. Are you allowed to do that in California?
No. Actually, in California, there is some places where you are allowed, but you have to have permission.
So, say private property where the owner allows it.
That's right.
You mentioned about the Border Patrol. Vicente and his group, they've developed a very close working relationship with the Border Patrol. Matter of fact, about 3 weeks ago, we searched with the Border Patrol in Calexico. We met them, the Border Patrol agents, at their office. We went to the border where the guy's wife, who jumped over the fence, we interviewed the wife to get as much information about what he was wearing, how he looked, what condition he was in, because he had only jumped over a few days ago. And with the Border Patrol, they invited us because they knew of our competency and expertise in searching the desert. They invited us to help them search for this guy. He made it to the canals and got washed away in the canals. And the sad thing is, was his daughter, he was jumping the fence to be at his first grandchild's birth, his daughter's first baby being born.
Heartbreaking. And so instead, she lost her father.
And she was there with us interviewing the mom. And she was in her young 20s, pregnant, just about to have a baby. And her dad was going to jump across to be there and help her. Mm. Made it to the canal, got washed away. We didn't find him, but her anguish, her sense, it was so palpable, her sense of trauma and stress. I couldn't imagine looking for my own father in the river bottoms.
I couldn't either. Did they ever find him?
We didn't find him that day, but about 2 days later, we got a call from the Border Patrol that their scuba divers did find his body down at the bottom of the canal, pinned up against a bridge support, because the canal moves pretty fast.
Very tragic.
And he couldn't swim, and she went into labor that day, the day they found her body, a month early from her due date.
Oh, my goodness. I'm curious. You say he jumped over a wall. We hear all this talk about the president wanting, President Trump wanting Congress to allocate $5 billion to build a wall. What was that wall like that man was able to jump over out there?
That's a good question. You can go see it. It's right in the middle, almost right in the middle of downtown Calexico.
Looks like you got a photo there to show me on the cell phone.
It's an established wall. It's probably 15 to 18 feet high. Four or five rows of serpentine razor wire.
Oh, my gosh. 15 feet high with razor wire all over it, rows and rows of it. So how do they think that this wall they're going to build is going to do what it says it's going to do if someone can get over a 15-foot wall
with razor wire? And it wasn't the wall that diverted this guy. It was he couldn't swim and couldn't make it across the canal. So the rest of this group made it. When they heard his voice yelling for help, they looked back and he wasn't there anymore. So the rest of the group made it. He got washed away. But it was, and they didn't have to cut the wire or damage the fence or anything. I don't know how they jumped over, but they managed to get over the top of the fence there.
So I guess the devil's advocate question would be, what would you say to those people who may be listening who are concerned about undocumented immigrants coming into the country? You know, they've been listening to the president talk about the migrant caravans and linking immigrants to, you know, everything, you name it, crime, gangs, terrorism concerns, is what he seems to think the wall would keep out. Of those people that you've gone and searched for, whether you found them or not, how many of them do you have any reason to believe were coming here for criminal purposes versus coming for visiting family, looking for work, those sorts of things?
You know, I've been working on the border, the actual border. Like I mentioned before, I was born on the border. The street I was born on the border, across the street is the wall in El Paso.
And how old
Texas.
Are you?
And I'm 80 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
So
so you remember before there was any wall.
Yeah. So I know a little bit about the border. Anyway. What needs to be done is to really look at the perspective of what is causing these people to come across the border.
Yes.
And you have to go look at where they live. And that's the Central America. That's Mexico, Central America. Not so much Mexico, because Mexico at this point in time, there's a zero net inflow.
Right. I mean, I should interject that a couple of years ago when the economy here was so bad, there was actually more people leaving here to go to Mexico than coming in. It was a negative immigration, migration from Mexico. So you're right. It's mostly Central American migrants. A lot of them are fleeing not just poverty, but violence with the cartels. They're fleeing for their lives. What is the answer? What should be done in your view, Vicente?
Well, I did graduate as an economist from University of California.
Very good.
And I believe that the Central American countries really have to be helped. They have to industrialize and get technology in there and do more trade. They really are an agrarian nation. That's their background. And there has been some things in history the past 30 years that have been unfortunate for them, where they could not follow a trend of becoming more industrialized and with a bigger economy.
When we spoke before we went on the air, you two were telling us a little bit about the history in Central America of U.S. involvement down there between our government and the corporations, and how that sort of led to some of the problems we're seeing today that are causing so many people to want to leave there. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, Henry?
Yeah, this is the part that I think is lost in the whole discussion of the border, is the historic context, and especially our involvement in that historic context as the United States. In the 50s, almost 80% of all of Guatemala didn't even belong to the Guatemalans. It would belong to American agricultural companies, Dole, Del Monte. There are stories you would hear about the indigenous people in Guatemala not even being able to afford a banana off their own plantation because it belonged to a U.S. international agricultural company. They had a democratic election where and voted in a president who promised agrarian reform, which of course meant that U.S. companies would lose their property. So the U.S. intervened and put in one of our own governments, which then led to one of the worst histories of all of Central America, what they call ethnocide. The government, it's documented that they killed over 200,000 indigenous Mayans throughout Guatemala in the Civil War, the 30 years of Civil War that followed the government that we put in there. And in Nicaragua, there's a great book everybody should read, written by a Maronite priest named John Donahue, called The Nicaraguan Revolution in Health, where the World Health Organization, the UN, identified Nicaragua as the model developing country in the world because of what they accomplished on grassroots development in terms of universal education for boys and girls, primary health care for boys and girls, education for boys and girls, 100% immunization, literacy rates. I mean, really amazing accomplishments with a very depressed economy, but because it was based on such a socialist model, we couldn't have that in our hemisphere. And so that's where we supported the Contras to undermine all of that accomplishment.
So it goes all the way back to the Iran-Contra scandal during the Reagan administration.
And many people, I'm not sure, remember that, or we conveniently seem to forget it. And the death squads in El Salvador that people should read about, the School of the Americas in Georgia, and how they ended up having to close it down because it was connected to so many human rights violations in Central America. So a lot of the problems these people are fleeing, I think, directly tied to our involvement in that part of the world. And as Colin Powell said in Iraq, you break it, you own it. And I think we broke a lot of these countries.
The pottery barn rule, he called it.
Yeah. And I don't think we can separate ourselves from the history of Central America or what these people are fleeing. And if I were in charge of $5.7 billion for the wall, I think it would be better spent on rebuilding the economies of Central America. Nobody wants to leave their family. Nobody wants to leave their children. Nobody wants to expose themselves to risk. And crossing the U.S. border is only part of the risk. They have to get to the U.S. border. A lot of these people are subject to all sorts of threats and hazards for 1,000 miles, even trying to get to the U.S. border.
Yeah,
for people exploiting them and kidnapping and extortionists and all sorts of other types of threats just to get here. And then they got to try to cross the border. And nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to leave their children. Nobody wants to leave their families. People just want to be able to provide. Everybody wants the same thing all over the world, which is an opportunity just to make a living and provide for your family.
Yeah,
I think if we allowed that to happen in Central America and we facilitated that, I think we wouldn't have an immigration challenge.
Those are very good points. And so I really appreciate you raising those. It just seems so logical in a lot of ways. If the wall were built, whether you think it's a good or bad idea, do you believe that ultimately it would cause more people to die by becoming more and more desperate in the ways they would try to come in? Or do you think that it might actually save lives by just making it so difficult that not very many people would try it?
You know, the number of deaths has been lowered lately in the last few years from what it was. I believe that there will still be a number of deaths because people tried to get back to their families, and one good example, that I know of, there's several of them just like this one, and that is where there was a man who was deported from California here and to Tijuana, and since the California border is somewhat secure, and it takes a lot of effort to get across, the man went to Arizona, to the desert, and crossed over there. We went to search for his body, and he was found. But he left on the U.S. side in California here. His wife and 5 children, the oldest of the children was a little girl, 9 years old. He isn't the only one that we have found. that has had five children surviving here in California. We do find a lot of the people that cross and have and die have two or three children.
That's just heartbreaking. How do you get your funding? I know that you're a nonprofit. If people are hearing this and they're interested in helping, how can they support you?
What we do for our funds, we go to Arizona quite often. Mm-hmm. And every time that we go, it takes somewhere around $1,500 to $2,000 to do a search. We arrive in Arizona with maybe 25 people, 20 people, whatever. We have a large gas expense. We have six vehicles, which are 4x4s, to drive in the desert. We have maintenance on them. We blow the tires and, of course, food and radios and all of that. So our expenses are somewhat on the heavy side. And so what we do is we go to swap meets and we set up a tent there with some pictures, posters, and of the remains that we find, and we ask for donations. And that's really the only way or the only funding that we get is what the people
and
donate
to us. You also have a GoFundMe site for Aguilas del Desierto. That's spelled A-G-U-I-L-A-S del D-E-L Desierto, D-E-S-I-E-R-T-O. And on the page, it mentions that often you're not able to respond quickly enough when a family tells you somebody has crossed and their life is in immediate danger because you just don't have enough money to go often enough or a vehicle is broken down. I mean, how important is it to get more funds so that you can save more lives?
If we have more funds, we wouldn't have spent so much time raising money on our own at the swap meets. So we could go more often. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, saving one life, there's no price that you can put on it.
How many lives do you save?
With all the work that we do, which includes the posters that we put out through all of Mexico and into Central America, warning about the dangers of the crossing the border, mm-hmm. we really don't know how many we save because we know that that poster saves many lives in addition to the ones that we find across the border. That poster tells them how to survive in the desert to get help.
Vicente just got back recently from spending, I don't know, about a month driving through, 2 months? Mexico and Central America, 7,000 miles in his car visiting a lot of the migrant centers and putting up these posters. And sometimes we get a phone call from somebody lost out in the desert and we ask them, where do you get the phone number from? And they said, well, the poster you left down in the migrant center in Mexico or something.
So you basically warn them that it's too dangerous and why they shouldn't cross, but if they do it anyway, how to get help if they get out there and they're in trouble.
The Facebook page also. As Vicente mentioned, we don't have any paid members at all. And it's amazing how much work it takes. It's not only going organizing the search, but there we probably get, and Vicente knows more about this than I do, phone calls every single day from somebody reporting somebody missing or lost, right?
Yes. We get up to 10 phone calls a day, especially in the summer.
My goodness.
People lost throughout the entire border because of that poster. And we share the information that we get with the Border Patrol, and they do the rescues or search for the remains. So we work in coordination with them.
And not only that, that's only the front end of it. Vicente, again, knows much more about this part. But even afterwards, after we find the remains or a body and coordinate with the Border Patrol or the Sheriff's Office or the Coroner's Office, then sometimes the U.S. Embassy and the Consulate get involved. Or if it's a Guatemalan national, the Guatemalan Embassy gets involved. And then they end up calling one of ours, like Eli, one of the founders, or Vicente, to triangulate communications or helping find the family member back home because I think there are 100,000 members members on the Facebook site that
That's
are all throughout Central America. And through the communication network that Aguilas has, they can help try to find somebody's family. So it's what we're trying to do is get enough money to be able to hire Ellie, who's receiving 10 phone calls a day, coordinating with the Border Patrol, coordinating where people are, where the remains are, what happens with the remains, how to reconnect with the family, how to repatriate the remains. So that's really our goal, is to try to free up enough time for somebody to be able to do more, because he's doing all of that on top of his full-time job.
Wow, that's very important work. A while back, when we first started the magazine 10 years ago, 11 years ago now, one of my first interviews was with Enrique Morones with Border Angels, and he took me out to the cemetery in Hemet, where at the time there were, I think, 400 or 600 graves of people who had died crossing the border and had not been identified. And at the time, he was asking the government for a program for DNA analysis so that they would be able to at least notify family back in Mexico or Central America what had happened to their loved ones. So do you ever find a body where you don't know who it is? And if so, are they doing the DNA testing right now to help bring some closure to these families?
Yes, when we find remains, whether it's one bone or skull or entire skeleton or body, we cannot touch it because our DNA will mix with that person or those remains. The coroner, forensic in Arizona, has said that they have, last year they said they had 1,400 remains.
Wow.
With DNA samples that they had. And what they do is they, every year, they have in October an event where the families can go and provide their DNA free of a charge to the forensics. It's put on actually by the sheriffs and forensics in Arizona. And then they'll compare that to one of the 1,400 that they lost, not last year, but the year before. I think they were able to identify something like 76 people altogether from the DNA. Mm,
that's good. At least there's something moving in the right direction.
And you mentioned about the partnership. The Border Patrol invites the Aguilas, because of the Aguilas' large network and connection, to collaborate on that project, because we can reach that information out to a lot of people, to encourage them to show up to volunteer some of their DNA so some of these 1,400 remains can be identified.
And if people want to volunteer and actually help on the searches, or maybe they have a 4x4 or an off-road vehicle, do you need that sort of help as well?
Yes, that really does help. You know, what it is you're out there in the wild. One of the places that we go to is it's about 35-40 miles from the border and to where they're going. It's another 35-40 miles. And it takes us driving in there on dirt roads hour and a half to get in there. That's how desolate it is where they're at. And so that's a big problem.
Not something that everybody could handle.
Yeah.
It's a challenging work, and you must have to have a true humanitarian spirit to do this. And Henry, well, for both of you, I mean, how difficult emotionally is that when you go out there and you find, you know, a body, the remains of someone's loved one? How does that impact you?
Well, for myself, when I'm growing up, I saw the first man that I saw killed at 5 years old.
Ooh.
And then I was in the Marine Corps, so I won't say I'm used to it, but
you're tough and you can handle it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Marianne, because when we go out there and we search and we don't find somebody, honestly, at the end of the day, I'm not sure that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not sure if you want to find somebody or not want to find somebody. Like I heard one of our searchers mentioned for a criticism, we don't bring happiness to people, but what we bring is closure to families. At least they know what happened to their son or their daughter or their mother or their father. It brings closure to families.
Yeah, very, very true. I'm going to ask each of you if you have any last words that you'd like to share with our listeners today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, the network for social justice.
Yes. We do have one big thing that we'd like to share with you is basically it's that we do need funding. We are still growing. We're a growing organization, and we do have on the website or and the Facebook, a spot where you can go to donate money. Henry can explain a little bit more about that than I can.
Okay, thank you so much.
On the Facebook page?
Yeah.
Yeah, go to the Facebook page, as Miriam mentioned, Aguilas del Desierto. Miriam, could we put something on the East County?
Yes, absolutely.
Also?
Listeners, if you didn't get that full email address or Facebook page, you can go on to eastcountymagazine.org, and if you click into our Latino Voices section under People Power, or in our top news section, either one, we will have a link up there. And the organization's name, again, is Aguilas del Desierto, AguilasDelDesierto. Or you can email me at editor@eastcountymagazine.org, and I can send you the information if you didn't catch it on the air.
The border and immigration is a really politically charged topic. It's very volatile, but what shouldn't be so volatile, what shouldn't be charged, is the whole expression and concept of compassion. And that's what has surprised me so much of my work with this, is how unsympathetic so many people are to the work of Aguilas and similar organizations. When I was out with Vicente, we were at the Qualcomm swap meet with a table set up, and the vast majority of people show up and drop $1, $5, $10, $20 bill to help us with our work. Every now and then somebody will show up and say, ah, no, forget it. We should put landmines out there. We should shoot them as they cross.
Oh my gosh.
And just, I mean, not only unsympathetic, but evil. And that has surprised me. And that is, to me, is so un-American. Because America, I think if you can ever identify a cross-cutting trait of America through history, has always been our international humanitarian nature. We're the number one country in the world who gives humanitarian aid to the UN, most food, the World Food Organization. So regardless what you think of immigration and the border, to withhold help from people who need help is revealed, reflected a part of our national, at least our local psyche, that to me is really disconcerting and reflects something that's terribly bothersome to me. It's very un-American.
Yeah, I think it's troubling on much the same level that the whole debate over the Trump administration removing children from families at the border, putting them into detention, and thousands of them, and losing track of them, admitting that they don't know where a lot of these children have gone. Why are we not seeing a national outrage from everyone, even if you're opposed to undocumented immigration?
That's right.
Should we not have compassion for children to be properly, you know, cared for, or for families to have closure if they've lost a loved one, you know, out in
the
desert?
That's part of this whole discussion I really don't get. It's like we can have political opinions, we can have policies, but at some line, you shouldn't sacrifice your sense of humanity and compassion for what's just fundamentally right and wrong. And you're right, separating children at the border from their parents, I mean, infants, that's just under anybody's worldview cannot be right, to the point that we've two children have already died.
Yeah.
And you're right. And how all of us have remained quiet on either side of the political lines is inconceivable to me in American psyche.
What I have to say is, you know, there's some people that want to put up a wall, but I look at the long term. I look at the long term and say, what will it be like in 1,000 years? In 1,000 years, the animals that live next to this wall will be separated. Some of them will become extinct.
Jaguars, bighorn sheep, or a couple of the species that are impacted.
And you're talking about many species. The other thing is, we don't know what country will be next to that wall 1,000 years from now. The United States may stretch all the way to Mexico City, or Mexico will stretch all the way to Canada. That's for future generations to decide.
Yeah. Interesting point. One thing we haven't talked about is the drug smugglers and the cartels. Governor Newsom has announced that he is going to be withdrawing most of the National Guard troops that Governor Brown had agreed to send down to the border, because Governor Brown had agreed to this under condition they not be used to rip families apart or enforce the federal immigration laws with which he disagreed, but that it was okay to have them there to go after the cartels. And apparently that's not how they've been being used, so he's withdrawing all but a handful of them that'll stay to guard for drugs. But the devil's advocate side is, gee, a wall might stop drug smugglers from coming in here, or bad people like terrorists. What is your response to that?
I think people have to understand really what's going on in the desert to answer that question reasonably with some logic. I mean, think about, okay, these migrants in the deserts where we're searching, they're taking 5 days at least to cross the desert. 5 to 9 days, you figure at least a gallon of water, and that's barely, that's minimum. A gallon of water a day, 5 days, there's 40 pounds of water. On top of that, you're going to need your food. So let's say another 5 to 10 pounds of food, and then some clothes and something to sleep in. You have no weight left to carry any drugs.
You're not going to be carrying a kilo of marijuana across that border.
This is not the place where drugs are being smuggled. I mean, true. It's all they can do, and many of them can't even do that, just to get themselves across the border, much less any kind of drugs of any quantity to worry about.
Right. I mean, the facts do show that the vast majority, almost all of the drugs that are seized coming into the United States are at ports of entry, being driven across in trucks, often by somebody who's a U.S. citizen or has, you know, permission to come in legally.
And terrorists, and the terrorist organizations, to me, they have so much resources, they're not going to risk one of their people spending 5 days out in the desert. The most difficult way to get into the United States to try to get into the U.S., if we look back at 9/11, of the 19 hijackers, 18 of them came in on visas.
True.
The vast majority of the people who are here for unrespectable reasons are here ways other than trying to get into the U.S. in the most difficult way to possibly get in.
Good point. They can simply buy a fake ID or come in on a visa and overstay it.
Exactly. That's so much easier just to get a visa and overstay it.
Yeah, very good point.
Why risk yourself out to get bit by a rattlesnake, you know, fall in the desert, die of heat stroke, or it just honestly makes no sense. You have to think this through a little bit.
Yeah.
The vast majority of the people out in the desert who are trying to cross really are the poorest of the poor. They're here either for job reasons or for family reasons or both. People with gang connections, terrorist connections, or cartel connections have way too much resources to waste their time trying to walk 5 days across the desert.
True. And I understand there's not really a legal way for people who just want to come here and visit a family member or look for a job as a low-wage worker to come here.
Yeah, people talk about, well, they should do it the legal way. And the little I do under when I read about this, it takes like 20 years to get a visa for a Mexican to come here to work for a work visa. So there really is no legal way to get here. We haven't facilitated. And what the wall has done and what data has shown is it hasn't so much stopped people from coming into the country. What it does is it keeps people from getting out of our country.
Yeah.
We've always had a very dynamic and fluid border with the economic reasons and migration reasons. Labor and money have flowed both ways for our whole history. And when we put the wall up, what it did is it kept that dynamic flow from happening. And a lot of people ended up getting stuck on this side of the border.
That's true. Once they get here, it's so difficult. They're not going to go back just to visit family. They wind up staying even between maybe the seasonal jobs they may have. And I know in Hucumba, people have told me when they built the border wall and closed the border crossing there, the town's economy dried up. People from Mexico who used to come up and shop were no longer doing so. So there's a lot of consequences to the wall and the immigration policies that are being pursued that I think a lot of people don't think about.
If we want to look at the safety of the American public, there are things that are much, much greater threats to our well-being. I mean, just look at school shootings. I mean, why isn't that a priority? Instead of a lone, maybe one-off migrant who may commit a crime here or there, you know. I think, what are we averaging, a school shooting a day or something?
And
let's build a wall around that.
Very good point. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with two humanitarians who are my guests today, Vicente Rodriguez and Henry Magala, with Aguilas del Desierto, which is a nonprofit organization, again, of volunteers whose mission is to search, rescue, and recover undocumented immigrants who become lost in our desert and mountain areas while crossing the border. And I really want to thank both of you for taking your time today to come on our show and share these important stories and help dispel some of these myths for our listeners today. So thank you for joining us on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you, Miriam.
Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to talk about the border and its issues.